Securing early wins. Armed with an understanding of your A-item priorities and objectives for behavior change, you can proceed to create detailed plans for how you will secure early wins during your first 90 days and beyond. You should think about what you need to do in two phases: building credibility in the first 30 days and deciding where you will focus your energy to achieve early performance improvements in the following 60 days. Building credibility. In your first few weeks in your new job, you cannot hope to have a measurable impact on performance, but you can score small victories and signal that things are changing. Your objective at this early stage is to build personal credibility. Because your earliest actions will have a disproportionate influence on how you are perceived, think through how you will get connected to your new organization. What messages do you want to get across about who you are and what you represent? What are the best ways to convey those messages? Identify your key audiences, direct reports, other employees, key outside constituencies, and craft a few messages tailored to each. These need not be about what you plan to do. That's premature. They should focus instead on who you are, the values and goals you represent, your style, and how you plan to conduct business. Think about modes of engagement, too. How will you introduce yourself? Should your first meetings with direct reports be one-on-one or in a group? Will these meetings be informal get-to-know-you sessions, or will they immediately focus on business issues and assessment? What other channels, such as email and video, will you use to introduce yourself more widely? Will you have early meetings at other locations where your organization has facilities? As you make progress in getting connected, identify and act as quickly as you can to remove minor but persistent irritants in your new organization. Focus on strained external relationships and begin to repair them. Cut out redundant meetings, shorten excessively long ones, or improve physical space problems. All this helps you to build personal credibility early on. When you arrive, people will rapidly begin to assess you and your capabilities. Your credibility, or lack of it, will depend on how people in the organization would answer the following questions about you. Number 1. Do you have the insight and steadiness to make the tough decisions? Number 2. Do you have values that they relate to, admire, and want to emulate? Number 3. Do you have the right kind of energy? Number 4. Do you demand high levels of performance from yourself and others? For better or worse, they will begin to form opinions based on little data. Your early actions, good and bad, will shape perceptions. Once opinion about you has begun to harden, it is difficult to change. And the opinion-forming process happens remarkably quickly. So how do you build personal credibility? In part, it is about marketing yourself effectively, much akin to building equity in a brand. You want people to associate you with attractive capabilities, attitudes, and values. There's no single right answer for how to do this. In general, though, new leaders are perceived as more credible when they are, number 1, demanding but able to be satisfied. Effective leaders press people to make realistic commitments and then hold them to those promises. But if you're never satisfied, you'll sap people's motivation. Accessible but not too familiar. Being accessible does not mean making yourself available indiscriminately. It means being approachable, but in a way that preserves your authority. Decisive but judicious. New leaders communicate their capacity to take charge without jumping too quickly into decisions that they are not ready to handle. Early in your transition, you want to project decisiveness but defer important decisions until you know enough to make them. Number 4. Focused but flexible. Avoid setting up a vicious cycle and alienating others by coming across as rigid and unwilling to consider multiple solutions to a problem. Effective new leaders establish authority by zeroing in on issues but consulting others and encouraging input. Number 5. Active without causing commotion. There's a fine line between building momentum and overwhelming your group or unit. Make things happen, but avoid pushing people to the point of burnout. Number 6. Willing to make tough calls, but humane. You may have to make tough calls right away, including letting marginal performers go. Effective new leaders do what needs to be done, but they do it in ways that preserve people's dignity and that others perceive as fair. Leveraging teachable moments. Your actions during your first few weeks in the organization will have symbolic resonance. To illustrate this, consider the experience of Laura Moore, who took over an underperforming unit at a major financial services company. Based on her early diagnosis, Lara knew the unit suffered from a severe case of bureaucratic sclerosis. This problem was symbolized by the floor-to-ceiling filing cabinets that her predecessor had maintained, documenting all his transactions and decisions, however trivial. One of Lara's first acts was to have all these cabinets removed, as people in the office looked on in amazement. Early actions often get transformed into stories, which can define you as a hero or a villain. Do you take the time to informally introduce yourself to the support staff, or do you focus only on your boss, peers, and direct reports? Something as simple as this can help brand you as accessible or remote. How you introduce yourself to the organizations, how you treat support staff, how you deal with small irritants, all of these pieces of behavior can become the kernels of stories that circulate widely. To nudge the mythology in a positive direction, look for and leverage teachable moments. These are actions, such as the way that Elena Lee dealt with the recalcitrant supervisors, that clearly display what you are about. They also model the kinds of behavior you want to encourage. They need not be dramatic statements or confrontations. It can be as simple and as hard as asking the penetrating question that crystallizes your group's understanding of some key problems they are confronting. Securing tangible results. Building personal credibility and developing some key relationships helps you get some immediate wins. Soon, however, you should be identifying opportunities to get some quick, tangible performance improvements in the business. The best candidates are problems that you can tackle reasonably quickly with modest expenditure and that will yield visible operational and financial gains. Examples include bottlenecks that restrict productivity and incentive programs that undermine performance by causing conflict. Identify two or three key areas, at most, where you will seek to achieve rapid improvement. If you take on too many initiatives, you risk losing focus. But don't put all your eggs in one basket. Think about risk management. Build a promising portfolio of early win initiatives so that big successes in one will balance disappointments in others. Then focus relentlessly on getting results. To set the stage for securing early wins, your learning agenda should specifically address how you will identify promising opportunities for improvement. To translate your goals into specific initiatives to secure early wins, work through the following guidelines. Number one, keep your long-term goals in mind. The actions that you take to secure early wins should, to the greatest extent possible, serve your A-item priorities and long-term goals for behavior change. Number two, identify a few promising focal points. Focal points are areas or processes, such as the customer service process for Elena Lee, where improvement can dramatically strengthen the organization's overall operational or financial performance. Other examples of focal points might include a mutual fund company's process for reporting to the Securities and Exchange Commission, or a pharmaceutical company's handoff from research to marketing. Number three, concentrate on the most promising focal points. Mastering a few focal points you identify will reduce the time and energy needed to achieve tangible results. Improving performance early in these areas will win you freedom and space to pursue more extensive changes. Number four, launch pilot projects. Design promising pilot initiatives targeted at your chosen focal points that you can understand right away. Successful early projects set your overall plan in motion, energize your people, and yield real improvements. This is what Elena Lee did first to begin to improve customer service in her new organization. Number five, elevate change agents. Identify the people in your new unit at all levels who have the insight, drive, and incentives to advance your agenda. Promote them, as Elena Lee did, to positions of increasing responsibility. Then send a message to everyone else by rewarding them lavishly for success. Number six, leverage the pilot projects to introduce new behaviors. Your early pilot projects, like Elena Lee's, should serve as models of how you want your organization, unit, or group to function in the future. Use the checklist in the accompanying narrative to help plan pilot projects with maximum impact. Pilot Project Checklist. For each pilot project you set up to secure early wins, use this checklist to be sure you are setting high standards for the kind of behavior you want to encourage. Number one, what is the right mix of people in terms of knowledge, skills, and personal chemistry? Number two, who has the credibility, the project management skills, and the creativity to lead the project? Number three, what are achievable stretch goals? Number four, what are achievable deadlines? Number five, what coaching or framework will you provide to guide team problem solving and decision making? Number 6. What other resources are necessary for success? Number 7. How will you hold people accountable for achieving superior results? Number 8. How will you reward success? Avoiding predictable surprises. All your efforts to secure early wins could come to naught if you don't pay attention to identifying ticking time bombs and preventing them from exploding in your face. If they do explode, your focus will instantly shift to continuous firefighting, and your hopes for systematically getting established and building momentum will fly out the window. Some bolts from the blue really do come out of the blue. When this happens, you simply have to gird your loins and mount the best crisis response that you can. But far more often, new leaders are taken off track by what my colleague Max Bazerman and I call predictable surprises. These are situations in which people have all the information necessary to identify the problem and take corrective action, but fail to do so. This often happens because the new leader simply doesn't look in the right places or ask the right questions. As discussed in Chapter 1, we have preferences about the types of problems we like to work on and those we prefer to avoid or don't feel competent to address. If you are a marketing person and are taking on leadership of a new product launch team, it would not be surprising if you focused more on the marketing aspects than on the manufacturing ramp-up. But you will also have to discipline yourself either to dig into areas in which you are not fully comfortable or to find trustworthy people with the necessary expertise to do so. Another reason for predictable surprises is that different parts of the organization have different pieces of the puzzle, but no one puts them together. Every organization has its information silos. If you don't put processes in place to make sure that critical information is surfaced and integrated, then you are putting yourself at risk of being predictably surprised. Use the following set of questions to identify areas where potential problems may be lurking. Number 1. External environment. Could trends in public opinion, government action, or economic conditions precipitate major problems for your unit? Examples. A change in government policy that favors competitors or unfavorably influences your prices or costs, a major shift in public opinion about the health or safety implications of using your product, an emerging economic crisis in a developing country. Number 2. Customers, markets, competitors, and strategy. Are there developments in the competitive situation confronting your organization that could pose major challenges? Examples. A study suggesting that your product is inferior to that of a competitor, a new competitor that is offering a lower-cost substitute, or a price war. Number 3. Internal capabilities. Are there potential problems with your unit's processes, skills, and capabilities that could precipitate a crisis? Examples. An unexpected loss of key personnel, major quality problems at a key plant, or a product recall. Number 4. Organizational politics. Are you in danger of unwittingly stepping on a political landmine? Examples. Certain people in your unit are untouchable, but you don't know it. Or you fail to recognize that a key peer is subtly undermining you. Leading change. As you work out where to get your early wins, think about how you're going to make change happen in your organization. Planned change versus collective learning. Once you have identified the most important problems or issues you need to address, the next step is to decide whether to engage, as my colleague Amy Edmondson has noted, in plan then implement change or promotion of collective learning. The straightforward plan then implement approach to change works well when you are sure that you have the following key support planks in place. Number 1. Awareness. A critical mass of people are aware of the need for change. Number 2. Diagnosis. You know what needs to be changed and why. Number 3. Vision. You have a compelling vision and a solid strategy. Number 4. Plan. You have the expertise to put together a detailed plan. Number 5. Support. You have a sufficiently powerful coalition to support implementation. The plan-then-implement approach to change might work well in turnaround situations, for example, where people accept there is a problem, the fixes are more technical than cultural or political, and people are hungry for a solution. If any of these 5 conditions are not met, however, the pure plan-then-implement approach to change can get you in trouble. If you are in a realignment, for example, and people are in denial about the need for change, they are likely to greet your plan with stony silence. You may therefore need to build awareness of the need for change, or sharpen the diagnosis of the problem, or create a compelling vision and strategy, or develop a solid cross-functional implementation plan, or create a coalition in support of change. To accomplish any of these goals, you would be well advised to focus on setting up a collective learning process and not on developing and imposing change plans. If many people in the organization are willfully blind to emerging problems, for example, you have to put in place a process to pierce through this veil. Rather than mounting a frontal assault on the organization's defenses, you should engage in something akin to guerrilla warfare, slowly chipping at their resistance and raising their awareness of the need for change. You can do this by exposing key people to new ways of operating and thinking about the business, such as new data on customer satisfaction and competitive offerings. Or you can do some benchmarking of best-in-class organizations, getting the group to analyze how your best competitors perform. Or you can bring people to envision new approaches to doing things, for example, by scheduling an off-site meeting to brainstorm about key objectives or about improving existing processes. The key, then, is to figure out which parts of the change process can best be addressed through planning and which are better dealt with through collective learning. Think of a change that you want to make in your new organization. Now use the diagnostic flowchart in Figure 4-2, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program, to figure out where collective learning processes are likely to be important to your success. Getting started on behavior change. As you plan to get early wins, remember that the means you use are as important as the ends you achieve. The initiatives you put in place to get early wins should do double duty by establishing new standards of behavior. Elena Lee did this when she carefully staffed and coached her project team and then quickly implemented their recommendations. To change your organization, you will likely have to change its culture. This is a difficult undertaking. Your organization may have well-ingrained bad habits that you want to break, but we know how difficult it is for one person to change habitual patterns in any significant way, never mind a mutually reinforcing collection of people. Simply blowing up the existing culture and starting over is rarely the right answer. People and organizations have limits on the change they can absorb all at once. And organizational cultures invariably have virtues as well as faults. They provide predictability and can be sources of pride. If you send the message that there is nothing good about the existing organization and its culture, you will rob people of a key source of stability in times of change. You will also deprive yourself of a potential wellspring of energy into which you could tap to improve performance. The key is to identify both the good and bad elements of the existing culture. Elevate and praise the good elements even as you seek to change the bad. These functional aspects of the familiar culture are a bridge that can help carry people from the past to the future. Matching strategy to situation. The choice of behavior change techniques should be a function of your group's structure, processes, skills, and, above all, its situation. Consider the difference between promoting behavior change in turnaround and realignment situations. In a turnaround, you face a combination of time pressure and the need to rapidly identify and secure the defendable core of the business. Techniques such as bringing in new people from the outside and setting up project teams to pursue specific performance improvement initiatives often are a good fit. Contrast this with realignments, where you are well advised to start out with less obvious approaches to behavior change. By changing performance measures and starting benchmarking, for example, you set the stage for collective visioning about how to realign the business. Finally, keep in mind your overarching goal, creating a virtuous cycle that reinforces wanted behavior and contributes to helping you achieve your A-item priorities. Remember that you are aiming at modest early improvements so you can pursue more fundamental changes. Acceleration checklist. Number 1. Given your situation, what should be the timing and extent of each of the waves of change you envision? Number 2. Based on what you know now, what are your A-item priorities? Given these priorities, what do you need to do during a transition to lay the necessary groundwork for achieving them? Number 3. How would you like to see people behave differently by the end of your era in the organization? Describe as vividly as you can the behaviors you would like to encourage and discourage. Number 4. What can you begin to do to change behaviors during your transition? Number 5. How do you plan to connect yourself to your new organization? Who are your key audiences and what messages would you like to convey to them? What are the best modes of engagement? 6, what are the most promising focal points for your early performance improvement efforts? Select one focal point and think about how early wins in this area could serve as a model for how you want people to behave. 7, given the changes you want to make, in what areas do you need to engage in collective learning? Chapter 5, Negotiate Success. When Michael Chen was promoted to manage the information technology, IT function, for a key business unit of an oil company, he was elated, until he received calls from two colleagues. Both told him the same thing. Start updating your resume. Cates is going to eat you alive. His new boss, Vaughn Cates, was a hard-driving manager with a reputation for getting results, and for being tough on people. Cates had recently taken over the unit, and several of the people she had inherited had already left. Michael's friends anticipated the problem. "You've had a lot of success," one said, "but Cates will think you're not aggressive enough. You're a planner and team builder. She'll think you're too slow and not up to the tough decisions." Forewarned, Michael laid the groundwork with Cates to gain time for diagnosis and planning. "I want to operate on a 90-day time frame, starting with 30 days to get on top of things," he told her. "Then I will bring you a detailed assessment and plan with goals and actions for the next 60 days. Michael updated Cates regularly on his progress. Pressed by her to make a call on a major systems purchase after 3 weeks, Michael held firm to his schedule. At the end of 30 days, he delivered a strong plan that pleased his new boss. A month later, Michael returned to report some early wins and to ask Cates for more headcount to advance a key project. She subjected him to withering questioning, but he was on top of his business case. Eventually, she agreed to his requests, but set some strict deadlines for achieving results. Armed with what he needed, Michael was soon able to report that he had met several interim targets. Building on his momentum, Michael raised the question of style at their next meeting. "We have different styles, but I can deliver for you," he said. "I want you to judge me on my results, not on how I get them." It took nearly a year, but Michael built a solid, productive working relationship with Cates. To succeed as Michael Chen did with a new boss, it is wise to negotiate success so you don't play a losing hand. It is well worth investing time in this critical relationship up front, because your new boss sets your benchmarks, interprets your actions for other key players, and controls access to resources you need. He or she will have more impact than any other individual on how quickly you reach the break-even point and on your eventual success or failure. Negotiating success means proactively engaging with your new boss to shape the game so you have a fighting chance of achieving desired goals. Too many new leaders just play the game, reactively taking their situation as given and failing as a result. The alternative is to shape the game by negotiating with your boss to establish realistic expectations, reach consensus on the situation, and secure enough resources. By negotiating effectively with Vaughn Cates, Michael laid the foundation for his success. Keep in mind that the nature of your relationship with your new boss should depend on your level in the organization and the business situation you face. The higher you rise, the more autonomy you are likely to get. This is especially the case if you and your boss are situated in different locations. Lack of oversight can be a blessing if you get what you need to succeed, or it can be a curse if you get enough rope to hang yourself. What you need from a boss also varies among the various STARS business situations. If you're in a realignment, you need your boss to help you make the case for change. In a sustaining success situation, you will need help to learn about the business and avoid early mistakes that threaten the core assets. In startups, you need resources and protection from too much high-level interference. In turnarounds, you may need to be pushed to cut back the business to the defendable core quickly. There is much you can do to build a productive working relationship with your new boss. This chapter will show you how to engage in the right kinds of dialogue and how to create a 90-day plan. Listen to it even if you will be reporting to the same boss in your new role. Your relationship won't necessarily stay the same in a changed situation. The boss's expectations may be different, and you may need more resources. Many managers mistakenly assume that they can continue to work with a current boss in the same way despite a different role. Don't make this error. Think also about how you might use the ideas in this chapter to accelerate relationship building with your own new direct reports. After all, don't you have a big stake in getting them to the break-even point as quickly as possible? Focusing on the fundamentals. When experienced managers are quizzed about how to build a productive relationship with a new boss, their observations typically emerge in the form of do's and don'ts. Let's start with the don'ts. Number one, don't trash the past. There is nothing to be gained and much to be lost by criticizing the people who led the organization before you arrived. This doesn't mean that you should tolerate mediocrity. You need to understand the past, but concentrate on assessing current behavior and results, and on making the changes necessary to support improved performance. Number two, don't stay away. If you have a boss who doesn't reach out to you, or with whom you have uncomfortable interactions, you will have to reach out yourself. Otherwise, you risk letting crippling communications or expectations gaps arise. It may feel good to be given a lot of rope, but resist the urge to take it. Get on your boss's calendar regularly. Be sure your boss is aware of the issues you face and that you are aware of the boss's expectations and whether and how they are shifting. Number three, don't surprise your boss. It is no fun bringing your boss bad news. The danger that the messenger, you, will be shot is very real. However, most bosses consider it a far greater sin not to report emerging problems early enough. Worst of all is for your boss to learn about a problem from someone else. It is usually best to give your new boss at least a heads up as soon as you become aware of a developing problem. Number four, don't approach your boss only with problems. You don't want to be perceived as bringing nothing but problems for your boss to solve. You need to have a plan, too. This emphatically does not mean that you have to fashion full-blown solutions. The outlay of time and effort needed to generate solutions can easily lure you down the rocky road to surprising your boss. The key here is to give just a few minutes thought to how to address the problem and to your role and the help you will need. Number five, don't run down your checklist. There is a tendency, even for senior managers, to use meetings with a boss as an opportunity to run through your checklist of what you've been doing. There are times when this is appropriate, but it is rarely what your boss needs or wants to hear. As one senior executive put it, I tell them, new direct reports, that I assume they are busy and that they should come to me to discuss what they are trying to do and how I can help them. Number six, don't try to change the boss. One accomplished manager told a story about scheduling a mid-afternoon meeting with his boss and immediately launching into a review of an important issue, only to discover the boss was falling asleep. The manager had been surprised when making the appointment to find the mid-afternoon time slot open, not just that day, but nearly every day. His peers had already figured out that the boss needed a regular nap then and scheduled meetings at other hours. The point? Assume that you are not going to change your boss and adapt to his or her style and idiosyncrasies. There are some fundamental do's as well. If you follow them, life with your new boss will be easier. Number one, take 100% responsibility for making the relationship work. This is the flip side of don't stay away. Don't expect your boss to reach out or offer you the time and support you need. It is best to begin by assuming that it is on your shoulders to make the relationship work. If your boss meets you partway, it will be a welcome surprise. Number two, clarify mutual expectations early and often. Begin managing expectations right away. You are in trouble if your boss expects you to fix things fast when you know the business has serious structural problems. It is wise to get bad news on the table early and to lower unrealistic expectations. Then check in regularly to make sure the boss's expectations have not shifted. Number three, negotiate timelines for diagnosis and action planning. Don't let yourself get caught up immediately in firefighting or pressured to make calls before you're ready. Buy yourself some time to diagnose the new organization and come up with an action plan. It worked for Michael Chen and his dealings with Vaughn Gates, and it can work for you. The 90-day plan discussed at the end of this chapter is an excellent vehicle for accomplishing this. Number four, aim for early wins in areas important to the boss. Whatever your own priorities, figure out what the boss cares about most. What are his or her interests and goals, and how does what you are doing fit into this picture? Once you know, aim for early results in those areas. One good way to do so is to focus on just three things that are important to your boss and to discuss what you are doing about them every time you interact. That way, your boss will feel some ownership of your success. But don't make the mistake of taking actions you think are misguided. In part, your job is to shape your boss's perceptions of what can and should be achieved. Number 5, pursue good marks from those whose opinions your boss respects. Your new boss's opinion of you will be based partly on direct interactions and partly on what he or she hears about you from trusted others. Your boss may have pre-existing relationships with people who are now your subordinates. You needn't curry favor with the people your boss trusts. Simply be alert to the multiple channels through which information about you and your performance will reach your boss. With these basic rules in mind, you can begin to plan how to engage with your new boss. Planning for 5 conversations. Your relationship with your new boss will be built through a continuing dialogue. Your discussions will begin before you accept the new position and continue into your transition and beyond. Several fundamental subjects belong at the center of this dialogue. In fact, it is valuable to include plans for 5 distinct conversations with your new boss about specific transition-related subjects in your 90-day plan. These are not subjects to be dealt with in separate appointments, but intertwined threads of dialogue. Number 1, the situational diagnosis conversation. In this conversation, you will seek to understand how your new boss sees the business situation. Is it a turnaround, a startup, a realignment, or a sustaining success situation? How did the organization reach this point? What factors, both soft and hard, make this situation a challenge? What resources within the organization can you draw on? Your views may differ from your boss's, but it is essential to grasp how he or she sees the situation. Number 2, the expectations conversation. Your agenda in this conversation will be to seek to understand and negotiate expectations. What does your new boss need you to do in the short term and in the medium term? What will constitute success? How will your performance be measured? When? You might conclude that your boss's expectations are unrealistic and that you need to work to reset them. Also, as part of your broader campaign to secure early wins, as discussed in Chapter 4, keep in mind that it is better to underpromise and overdeliver. Number 3, the style conversation. This conversation is about how you and your new boss can best interact on an ongoing basis. What form of communication does he or she prefer? Face-to-face? In writing? By voicemail or email? How often? What kinds of decisions does he or she want to be consulted on, and when can you make the call on your own? How do your styles differ, and what are the implications of your differences for how you should interact? Number 4, the resources conversation. This conversation is essentially a negotiation for critical resources. What is it that you will need to be successful? What do you need your boss to do? The resources in question need not be limited to funding or personnel. In a realignment, for example, you may need help from your boss to persuade the organization to confront the need for change. Number 5, the personal development conversation. Finally, discuss how your tenure in this job will contribute to your personal development. In what areas do you need improvement? Are there projects or special assignments you could undertake without sacrificing focus? Are there courses or programs that would strengthen your capabilities? In practice, your dialogue about these subjects will mingle threads and evolve over time. You might address several of the 5 issues in a single meeting, or you might work out issues related to one subject through a series of brief exchanges. Michael Chen covered style and expectations in a single meeting and established a schedule for talking about the situation and more deeply about expectations. There is a logic to the sequence just described, however. Your early conversations should focus on situational diagnosis, expectations, and style. As you learn more, you will be ready to negotiate for resources, revisiting your diagnosis of the situation and resetting expectations as necessary. When you feel the relationship is reasonably well established, you can introduce the personal development conversation. Take some time to plan for each conversation and signal clearly to your boss what you hope to accomplish in each exchange. The detailed guidelines that follow will help you plan each of the 5 conversations with your new boss. Planning the situation conversation. Reaching a shared understanding of the business situation you face and of its associated challenges and opportunities is your goal in the situational diagnosis conversation. This shared understanding is the foundation for everything you will do. If you and your boss do not define your new situation in the same way, you will not receive the support you need to achieve your objectives. Thus, your first discussion with your new boss should center on clearly defining your new situation using the STARS model as a shared language. Match support to your situation. The support you need from your boss will depend on the scenario, whether it is a startup, turnaround, realignment, or a sustaining success situation. Once you reach a common understanding of the situation, think carefully about the role you would like your new boss to play and what kind of support you will ask for. In all 4 situations, you will need your boss to give you the direction, support, and space to do your job. Table 5-1, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program, lists typical roles your boss might play in each of the STARS situations. Planning the expectations conversation. The point of the expectations conversation is for you and your boss to clarify and align your expectations about the future. You need to agree on short and medium-term goals, on timing, and on how your boss will measure progress. What will constitute success for your boss and for you? When does your boss expect to see results? How will you measure success? Over what time frame? If you succeed, what is next? If you don't manage expectations, they will manage you. Match expectations to the situation. Closely align your expectations with your shared assessment of the situation. In a turnaround situation, for example, you and your boss would probably agree on the need to take decisive action quickly. You would both have explicit expectations for the immediate future, such as making difficult decisions to reduce costs in non-essential areas or concentrating on the products with the highest margins. In this scenario, you would probably measure success by improvements in the business's overall financial performance. Aim for early wins in areas important to your boss. Whatever your own priorities, pinpoint what your boss cares about most and aim for some early wins in those areas. If you want to succeed, you need your boss's help. In turn, you should help your boss succeed. When you pay attention to your boss's priorities, he or she will feel ownership in your success. The most effective and synergistic approach is to integrate your boss's goals with your own efforts to get early wins. If this is impossible, look for some early wins based solely on your boss's priorities. Identify the untouchables. If there are parts of the organization, products, facilities, people, about which your new boss is proprietary, it is essential to figure out what they are as soon as possible. You don't want to find out that you are pressing to shut down the product line that your boss started up or to replace someone who has been his or her loyal ally. So try to deduce what your boss is sensitive about. You can do this by understanding your boss's personal history, by talking to others, and by paying close attention to facial expression, tone, and body language. If you are uncertain, float an idea gently as a trial balloon and then watch the boss's reaction closely. Educate your boss. One of your immediate tasks is to shape your boss's perception of what you can and should achieve. You may find your boss's expectations unrealistic or simply at odds with your own beliefs about what needs to be done. If so, you will have to work hard to make your views converge. In a realignment situation, for example, your boss may attribute the worst problems to a certain part of the business, whereas you believe they lie elsewhere. In this case, you will need to educate your boss about the underlying problems to reset expectations. Proceed carefully, especially if your boss feels invested in the way things have always been or is partly responsible for the problems. Underpromise and overdeliver. Whether you and your boss agree on expectations, try to bias yourself somewhat towards underpromising achievements and overdelivering results. This strategy contributes to building credibility. Consider how your organization's capacity for change might affect your ability to deliver on the promises you make. Be conservative in what you promise. If you deliver more, you will delight your boss. But if you promise too much and fail to deliver, you risk undermining your credibility. Even if you do a great deal, you will have failed in the boss's eyes. Clarify, clarify, clarify. Even if you are sure you know what the boss expects, you should go back regularly to confirm and clarify. Some bosses know what they want but are not good at expressing it. You could reach clarity only after you have headed down the wrong road. So you have to be prepared to keep asking questions until you are sure you understand. Try, for example, asking the same questions in different ways to gain more insight. Work at reading between the lines accurately and develop good hypotheses about what your boss is likely to want. Try to put yourself in your boss's shoes and understand how his or her boss will evaluate him or her. Figure out how you fit into the larger picture. Above all, don't let key issues remain ambiguous. Ambiguity about goals and expectations is dangerous. As one new leader put it, a tie in a conflict over what was said about expectations in an earlier conversation doesn't go to you. It goes to your supervisor. Working with multiple bosses. You face even more daunting challenges in managing expectations if you have more than one boss or are situated in a different location from your boss. The same fundamental principles hold, but the relative emphasis shifts. If you have multiple bosses, you have to be sure to balance perceived wins and losses among them carefully. If one boss has substantially more power, then it makes sense to bias yourself somewhat in his or her direction early on, so long as you redress the balance, to the greatest extent possible, later. If you can't get agreement by working with your bosses one-on-one, you have to essentially force them to come to the table together to thrash issues out. Otherwise, you will get pulled to pieces. Working at a distance. Managing when you are located far from your boss presents a different set of challenges. The risk of falling out of step without realizing it is naturally greater. This puts the onus on you to exert even more discipline over communication, scheduling calls and meetings to be sure that you stay aligned. It also is even more critical to establish clear and comprehensive metrics so that your boss gets a reasonable picture of what is going on and you can manage effectively by exception. Planning the style conversation. People's stylistic preferences affect how they learn, communicate, influence others, and make decisions. In the style conversation, your agenda will be to determine how you and your boss can best work together on a continuing basis. This was the key challenge that Michael Chen faced in working out his relationship with Vaughn Cates. Even if your boss never becomes a close friend or mentor, it is essential that he or she respect your professional capabilities. Diagnose your boss's style. The first step is to diagnose your new boss's working style and to figure out how it jibes with your own. If you leave voicemail messages for her about an urgent problem and she doesn't respond quickly, but then reproaches you for not giving her a heads up about the problem, take note. Your boss doesn't use voicemail. How does your boss like to communicate? How often? What kinds of decisions does your boss want to be involved in? And when can you make the calls on your own? Does your boss arrive at the office early and work late? Does he or she expect others to do the same? Pinpoint the specific ways in which your styles differ and what those differences imply about how you will interact. Suppose you prefer to learn by talking with knowledgeable people, whereas your boss relies more on reading and analyzing hard data. What kind of misunderstandings and problems might this stylistic difference cause, and how can you avoid them? Or suppose your new boss tends to micromanage while you prefer a lot of independence. What can you do to manage this tension? You may find it helpful to talk to others who have worked with your boss in the past. Naturally, you have to do this judiciously. Be careful not to be perceived as eliciting criticism of how the boss manages. Stick to less fraught issues, such as how the boss prefers to communicate. Listen to others' perspectives, but base your evolving strategy chiefly on your own experience. Observe, too, how your boss deals with others. Is there consistency? If not, why not? Does the boss have favorites? Is he particularly prone to micromanaging certain issues? Has he come down hard on a few people because of unacceptable performance? Scope out the dimensions of your box. Your boss will have a comfort zone about involvement in decision-making. Think of this zone as defining the boundaries of the decision-making box in which you will operate. What sort of decisions does your boss want you to make on your own but tell her about? Are you free, for example, to make key personnel decisions? When does she want to be consulted before you decide? Is it when your actions touch on broader issues of policy, for example, in granting people leave, or when there are hot political issues associated with some of the projects you're working on? When does she want to make the decision herself? Initially, expect to be confined to a relatively small box. As your new boss gains confidence in you, the dimensions of the box should increase. If not, or if it remains too small to allow you to be effective, you may have to address the issue directly. Adapt to your boss's style. Assume that the job of building a positive relationship with your new boss is 100% your responsibility. In short, this means adapting to his or her style. If your boss hates voicemail, don't use it. If he or she wants to know in detail what is going on, over-communicate. Do not do anything that could compromise your ability to achieve superior business results, but do look for opportunities to smooth the day-to-day workings of your relationship. Others who have worked with your boss can tell you what approaches they found successful. Then, judiciously experiment with the tactics that seem most promising in your case. When in doubt, simply ask your boss how he or she would prefer you to proceed. Address the difficult issues. When serious style differences arise, it is best to address them directly. Otherwise, you run the risk that your boss will interpret a style difference as disrespect or even incompetence on your part. Raise the style issue before it becomes a source of irritation, and talk with your boss about how to accommodate both your styles. This conversation can smooth the path for both of you in achieving your goals. One proven strategy is to focus your early conversations on goals and results instead of how you achieve them. You might simply say that you expect to notice differences in how the two of you approach certain issues or decisions, but that you are completely committed to achieving the results to which you have both agreed. An assertion of this kind prepares your boss to expect differences. You may have to remind your boss periodically to focus on the results you are achieving, not on your methods. It may also help to judiciously discuss style issues with someone your boss trusts, who can enlighten you about potential issues and solutions before you raise them directly with your boss. If you find the right advisor, he or she may even help you broach a difficult issue in a non-threatening manner. Don't make the mistake of trying to address all style issues in a single conversation. Nevertheless, a dialogue explicitly devoted to style is an excellent place to start. Expect to continue to be attentive to and adapt to the boss's style as your relationship evolves. Planning the resources conversation. The resources conversation is an ongoing negotiation with your new boss for critical resources. Before you launch this conversation, you should agree with your boss on the business situation you face, goals and expectations, and mutually effective working styles. Now you must secure the resources you need to meet expectations. The resources you need will depend on the situation and differ at different points in time. Number one, in a startup situation, your most urgent needs are likely to be adequate financial resources, technical support, and people with the right expertise. Number two, in a turnaround situation, you need authority, backed by political support, to make the tough decisions and secure scarce financial and human resources. In a realignment situation, you need consistent, public backing to get the organization to confront the need for change. Ideally, your boss will stand shoulder to shoulder with you, helping to pierce through denial and complacency. In a sustained success situation, you require financial and technical resources to sustain the core business and exploit promising new opportunities. You also need periodic pushes to set stretch goals that will keep you from drifting into complacency. The first step is to decide what resources, tangible and intangible, you must have to succeed. Identify the resources already available to you, such as experienced people or new products ready to be launched. Then identify the resources you will need help in obtaining. Ask yourself, what exactly do I need from my boss? The sooner you can articulate the resources you need, the sooner you can broach these requests in conversation with your boss. It is best to put as much as possible on the table as early as possible. Try using the menu approach by laying out the costs and benefits of different levels of resource commitment. If you want my sales to grow 7% next year, I need investment of X amount of dollars. If you want 10% growth, I will need Y amount of dollars. Going back to the well too often is a sure way to lose credibility. If it takes more time to get a handle on what resources you need to achieve specific goals, then so be it. Michael Chen negotiated for the necessary time, a critical resource, so he could avoid this problem. Play or change the game. You may be able to achieve your goals by playing the game according to the prevailing rules. If you can maneuver within the accepted cultural and political norms, your resource requests will be expected, and you will find it easier to get what you need. In other situations, notably realignments and turnarounds, You may need to change or even abandon established ways of doing business. Your resource requests will probably be more sweeping, and failure to secure them more damaging. You will have to negotiate harder to get what you need. These circumstances call for being clear about how the situation, expectations, and resources all have lined up to give you a reasonable shot at success. Clarify your needs in your own mind before you enter these discussions, back them up with as much hard data as you can get, and prepare to explain exactly why you see certain resources as essential. Then, stick to your guns. Keep coming back. Enlist others to help make your case. Seek out allies within and outside your organization. It is better to push too hard than to slowly bleed to death. Negotiate for resources. As you seek commitments for resources, keep these principles of effective negotiation in mind. Number one, focus on underlying interests. Probe as deeply as possible to understand the agendas of your boss and any others from whom you need to secure resources. What is in it for them? Number two, look for mutually beneficial exchanges. Seek resources that both support your boss's agenda and advance your own. Look for ways to help peers advance their agendas in return for help with yours. Number three, link resources to results. Highlight the performance benefits that will result if more resources are dedicated to your unit. Create a menu laying out what you can achieve and not achieve with current resources and what different size increments would allow you to do. Planning the personal development conversation. Finally, when your relationship with your boss has matured a bit, begin to discuss how your tenure in this position will contribute to your personal development. What skills do you need to develop to do the job better? Are there shortcomings in your management capacities that you need to try to address? Are there projects or special assignments that you could get involved in without sacrificing focus that could strengthen your skills? Are there formal courses or programs that would strengthen your capabilities? It is especially critical that you do this when you are making key career passages. If you are a first-time manager, get in the habit early of asking your boss for feedback and help in developing your supervisory skills. Your willingness to seek candid feedback on your strengths and weaknesses, and, critically, your ability to act on the feedback, send a powerful message. The same fundamental principle holds whether you are becoming a manager of managers for the first time, a functional leader, a general manager, or a CEO. Whenever you are at a point in your career when success demands a different set of skills and attitudes, discipline yourself to be open to learning from others who have gone before you. Don't restrict your focus to hard skills. The higher you rise, the more important the key soft skills of cultural and political diagnosis, negotiation, coalition building, and conflict management will become. Formal training can help, but developmental assignments in project teams, in new parts of the organization, in different functions, in different locations, are indispensable in honing these key managerial skills. Putting it all together, your 90-day plan. No matter what type of situation you're entering, it can be useful to put together a 90-day plan and to get buy-in from your boss. Usually, you will be able to devise a plan after a couple of weeks in the new job, when you have begun to connect with the organization and to get the lay of the land. Your 90-day plan should be written, even if it just consists of bullet points. It should specify priorities and goals, as well as milestones. Critically, you should share it with your boss and seek buy-in for it. It should serve as a contract between the two of you about how you are going to spend your time, spelling out both what you will do and what you will not do. To begin to develop your plan, divide the 90 days into three blocks of 30 days. At the end of each block, you will have a review meeting with your boss. Naturally, you are likely to interact more often than that. You should typically devote the first block of 30 days to learning and building personal credibility. Like Michael Chen, you should negotiate for this early learning period and then try to hold your boss to that agreement. Then you can proceed to develop a learning agenda and learning plan for yourself. Set weekly goals for yourself and establish a personal discipline of weekly evaluation and planning. Your key outputs at the end of the first 30 days will be a diagnosis of the situation, identification of key priorities, and a plan for how you will spend the next 30 days. This plan should address where and how you will begin to seek some early wins. Your review meeting with your boss should focus on the situation and expectations conversations, with an eye to reaching consensus about the situation, clarification of expectations, and buy-in to your plan for the next 30 days. Continue the weekly discipline of evaluation and planning. At the 60-day mark, your review meeting should focus on assessing your progress towards the goals of your plan for the previous 30 days. You should also discuss what you plan to achieve in the next 30 days, that is, by the end of 90 days. Depending on the situation and your level in the organization, your goals at this juncture might include identifying the resources necessary to pursue major initiatives, fleshing out your initial assessments of strategy and structure, and presenting some early assessments of your team. Developing yourself as a boss. Finally, you won't merely have a new boss, you are likely to be a new boss as well. You will almost certainly have new subordinates. Just as you need to adopt a productive relationship with your new boss, so too they need to work effectively with you. In the past, have you done a good job of helping subordinates make their own transitions? What might you do differently this time? Think about how to apply all the advice in this chapter to work with your own direct reports. The golden rule of transitions is to transition others as you would wish to be transitioned yourself. Listen to the golden rule of transitions following this passage. The same five conversation framework can help to build productive relationships with the people who report to you. Introduce the framework to them right away and schedule a first conversation with each of them to talk about the situation and about your expectations. Get them to do some pre-work before the meeting. For example, listening to Chapter 3 on matching strategy to situation. See how fast you can accelerate their transitions. Finally, seek to learn from bad bosses as well as good ones. You will inevitably experience a less than stellar boss at some point in your career. A surprising number of managers remark that, "I've learned more from my bad bosses than my good ones." Bad bosses force them to think about the negative impact of a bad boss. If you find yourself suffering under a bad boss, take the time to figure out his or her faults and what good bosses do differently, and then apply those insights to yourself. The golden rule of transitions. Think about how you would like new bosses to help you transition into new roles. Ideally, what kinds of guidance and support would they give you? Now, think about how you deal with new direct reports. What kind of guidance and support do you give them? Now, juxtapose these assessments. Do you transition others as you would wish to be transitioned yourself? If there is a big inconsistency between how you would prefer to be dealt with as a new direct report and how you deal with new direct reports, then you are part of the problem. Helping direct reports to accelerate their transitions is about more than being a good manager and contributing to others' development. The faster your direct reports get up to speed, the better able they will be to help you reach your goals. Acceleration checklist. Number 1. How effectively have you built relationships with new bosses in the past? What have you done well? In what areas do you need improvement? Number 2. Create a plan for the situational diagnosis conversation. Based on what you know now, what issues will you raise with your boss in this conversation? What do you want to say up front? In what order do you want to raise these issues? Number 3. Create a plan for the expectations conversation. How will you figure out what your new boss expects you to do? Number 4. Create a plan for the style conversation. How will you figure out how your boss prefers to interact with you? What mode of communication, email, voicemail, or face-to-face, does he or she prefer? How often should you interact? How much detail should you provide? What types of issues should you consult with him or her about before deciding? Number 5. Create a plan for the resources conversation. Given what you need to do, what resources are absolutely needed? With fewer resources, what would you have to forego? If you had more resources, what would the benefits be? Be sure to build the business case. Number 6. Create a plan for the personal development conversation. What are your strengths and where do you need improvement? What kinds of assignments or projects might help you develop the skills you need? Chapter 6. Achieve Alignment. Hannah Jaffe, a former human resources consultant, took a position as vice president of human resources at an investment services company. The organization was suffering from such intense internal conflict that some senior executives were barely on speaking terms. Hannah's job was to support the president in making personnel changes and to turn the situation around. Hannah soon realized the company's structure and incentive system needed overhauling as well. As the company had grown, senior management had organized new products into separate business units. With recent market changes, several units' customer bases overlapped, yet the units had no incentives to cooperate. The result? Confused customers and conflicts over which unit owned key customer relationships. Convinced the company needed structural realignment, Hannah approached her new boss, the president of the company. She laid out her case, but he remained convinced the people were the problem. The organizational structure had worked well in the past, he told Hannah, and with the right people in place, it would work again. But Hannah kept coming back to him on the issue. She brought to his attention situations in which incentive misalignments were unnecessarily stoking conflict. She also collected data on how other companies had organized to deal with similar issues. It took some time, but eventually Hannah convinced the president that the firm needed structural changes as well as personnel changes. The company shifted the focus of its marketing and sales units from products to customers and consolidated operations into a single group that supported all units. At the same time, the president brought in a new head of sales. The realignment worked. A year later, the company was functioning smoothly, customers were much happier, and profits were up 15%. The higher you climb in organizations, the more you take on the role of organizational architect, creating the context within which others can achieve superior performance. No matter how charismatic you are, you cannot hope to do much if the key elements in your unit are fundamentally out of alignment. You will feel like you are pushing a boulder uphill every day. If strategy, structure, systems, and skills are within your purview in your new position, you need to begin to analyze the architecture of your organization and assess alignment among these key elements. You can't hope to do much more than conduct a solid diagnosis and perhaps get started on addressing alignment issues in the first few months. But plans to assess the architecture of your group and to begin identifying areas for improvement should be included in your 90-day plan. Armed with the resulting insights, you can begin to take actions during your transition to align strategy, structure, systems, and skills, thus making superior performance possible. Naturally, this is not something that you can complete in a few months, but it is essential that you get started on fixing the worst realignments. In fact, this may be a key way you create value and reach the break-even point in your organization. Even if, like Hannah Jaffe, you lack the authority to alter your new organization single-handedly, you should still read this chapter. You may need to convince influential people, your boss, or your peers, that serious misalignments are a key impediment to achieving superior performance. Also, a thorough understanding of organizational alignment can help you build credibility with people higher in the organization and demonstrate your potential for more senior positions. Designing organizational architecture. Begin by thinking of yourself as the architect of your unit or group. This may be a familiar role for you, but it probably isn't. Few managers get systematic training in organizational design. Because managers typically have limited control over organizational design early in their careers, they learn little about it. It is commonplace for less senior people to complain about misalignments and to wonder aloud why those idiots, higher up, let obviously dysfunctional arrangements continue. By the time you reach the mid-senior levels of most organizations, however, you are well on your way to becoming one of those idiots. You are therefore well advised to begin learning something about how to assess and design organizations. To equip your group to achieve its goals, five elements of organizational architecture all need to work together. Number one, strategy, the core approach the organization will use to accomplish its goals. Number two, structure, how people are situated in units and how their work is coordinated. Number three, systems, the processes used to add value. Number four, skills, the capabilities of the various groups of people in the organization. And number five, culture, the values, norms, and assumptions that shape behavior. Certainly, you need a focused strategy to move forward effectively, but misalignments among any of these five elements can make even the best strategy useless. Strategy drives the other elements and is influenced by them. For example, if you decide to change your group's strategy, you will probably have to alter its structure, systems, and skills to support the new plan. As Figure 6-1 shows, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program, clarifying your strategy and aligning the supporting elements have to go hand in hand. Identifying misalignments. Organizations can end up misaligned in many ways. Your goal during your first 90 days should be to identify potential misalignments and then design a plan for correcting them. Common types of misalignment include the following. Number one, skills and strategy misalignment. Suppose you had an R&D group and your goal is to increase the number of new product ideas your team generates. However, your group does not understand the latest techniques and support tools that would let you run more experiments faster than before. In this case, your group's skills do not support its strategy. Number two, system and strategy misalignment. Imagine that you are leading a marketing group whose strategy is to focus on a new customer segment. If the group has not established an effective way to compile and analyze information about those customers, your group's systems fail to support its strategy. Structure and systems misalignment. Suppose you manage a product development group whose members are organized by product line. The rationale for this structure is that it focuses specialized technical expertise on specific products. But this structure has a downside. The group does not have efficient systems for integrating the overlapping expertise of different product teams. The resulting mismatch between structure and systems would make it difficult for the entire group to perform optimally. Avoiding some common traps. Too many managers rely on simplistic fixes to address complicated alignment problems. Be alert to these all too common pitfalls. Number one, trying to restructure your way out of deeper problems. Overhauling your group's structure in times of trouble can amount to straightening the deck chairs on the Titanic. Resist doing so until you understand whether restructuring will address the root causes of the problem. Otherwise, you may create new misalignments and have to backtrack, disrupting your group, lowering productivity, and damaging your credibility. Number two, creating structures that are too complex. This is a related trap. Although it may look good on paper to create a structure, such as a matrix, in which people in different units share accountability and in which creative tensions get worked out through their interactions, too often the result is bureaucratic paralysis. Strive where possible for clear lines of accountability. Simplify the structure to the greatest degree possible without compromising core goals. Number three, automating problem processes. Automating your group's core processes may produce significant gains in productivity, quality, and reliability, but it is a mistake to simply speed up an existing process through technology if the process has serious underlying problems. Automation will not solve such problems and may even amplify them. Analyze and streamline processes first, then decide whether automating them still makes sense. Number four, making changes for change's sake. Resist the temptation to tear down the fences before you know why they were put up. New leaders who feel self-imposed pressure to put their stamp on the organization often make changes in strategy or structure before they really understand the business. Here again, the action imperative discussed in Chapter 2 creates a sure recipe for disaster. Number five, overestimating your group's capacity to absorb strategic shifts. It is easy to envision an ambitious new strategy. In practice, though, it is difficult for a group to change in response to large-scale strategic shifts. Advance incrementally if time allows. Focus on a vital few priorities. Make modest changes to your group's strategy. Experiment, and then progressively refine structure, processes, skills, and culture. Getting started. Aligning an organization is like preparing for a long sailing trip. First, you select your destination, the mission and goals, and your route, the strategy. Then you figure out what boat you need, the structure, how to outfit it, the systems, and the crew mix, the skills. Throughout the journey, you keep an eye out for reefs that are not on the charts. The underlying point is that there is a logic to organizational alignment. Changing the structure before you figure out the strategy is unlikely to be productive. Also, you cannot assess the fitness of your existing crew until you have a handle on your destination, route, and boat. Number one, start with strategy. Begin by taking a hard look at how your unit is positioned with respect to the larger organization's goals and your A-item priorities. Make sure your strategy is well thought through and logically integrated. Number two, look at supporting structure, systems, and skills. Next, look at whether your group's existing structure, systems, and skills will support the change in strategy you envision. Dig into and understand these capabilities. If one or more of them is ill-suited to the strategy you have in mind, figure out how you will adapt your strategy and build, or acquire, the capabilities you need. Decide how and when you will introduce the new strategy. Armed with a deeper understanding of your group's current capabilities, chart a path for shifting strategy, if such a shift is necessary, Block out both changes in positioning, markets, customers, and suppliers, and changes in supporting capabilities. Then adopt a realistic time frame for making these changes. Number 4. Reshape structure, systems, and skills simultaneously. There is little point in reshaping your group's structure until you have worked out the implications of doing so for systems and for the supporting skills of your group. Avoid the temptation to deal with structure and systems in isolation. They are tightly linked. Number 5. Close the loop. As you learn more about your group's structure, systems, and skills, you will gain insight into the team's capabilities and its cultural capacity for change. This insight will in turn deepen your understanding of what changes in strategic positioning are possible over what time period.